review quantum field theory in the continuum, and then just see how we can carry it across to the causal set. So, jumping straight in, a causal set is a partially ordered set. So that means it's a pair C and a binary relation called C. And so this satisfies Drake's rules, so it's reflexive, it's anti symmetric, so if x exceeds y and y exceeds x, then x and y have to be the same point. It's transitive, so if x exceeds y, exceeds z, because x exceeds z. And these three properties just mean that this is a partial order. Now, this is motivated from considering the causal relation in the Lorentzian manifold. So there, the points are space-time points in the manifold, and the relation is that there exists a future-directed non-space-like curve from x to y, when we say x precedes. So here we're just taking these conditions, and we impose a fourth condition. And this is where the discreteness comes in. We say that if you consider the set of all z, that are causally between x and y, then the cardinality of this set, noted here by these vertical lines, is finite. So this is saying, so the idea is that the space-time, this set C, represents the space-time of x, and this order relation represents the causal relationships between us. So, just as a notational thing, we're going to write x strictly precedes if x precedes y, x and y are different.
You made no assumption on the cardinal of C itself. Like, it can be infinite, it can be...
Yeah, so in general causal set theory, it can be infinite. Say countably infinite. As it turns out, the final property that we're going to develop is currently only defined for finite. So it's an interesting question about how to extend. Okay, so maybe it's helpful to have an example. So consider a four-element causal set. With these, where we've labeled our elements like this, and the, and we're going to have these causal relations. Okay, so this is one way to represent the causal set. Another way is to draw it as a directed graph. So I haven't written down the relations V1 precedes V1. That's just too much. So you can draw it as a graph where the points... I think that's what I meant. So you can draw it where you draw the elements of your causal set as points in the plane, and the relations between distinct elements as directed lines. So this is just a visual way of representing exactly the same causal set. So I've chosen to draw these extra lines in just to make it clear that they are there. But often they're drawn as a Hasse diagram, where you just don't draw the relations that are implied by transitivity. Another way to represent a finite causal set is by its adjacency matrix. Before we define these, we're just going to define the notion of a link. This will turn out to be important. A link is a relation between two distinct elements, such that there does not exist another element in C with U precedes W precedes. So over here, we can see that V2 precedes V3 is a link, but V2 precedes V4 is not a link, because there exists V3 causally between. Okay? So there's two adjacent matrices of interest. So for a causal set with P elements, P1, P2, P, we can define this causal matrix C. And we can define the link matrix. This is 1 or 0. If okay. So for this particular example, we can write down these causal matrix. So I just want to make it clear that given a finite causal set, these are just, in general, very big square matrices of ones and zeros. Okay? Now, there's one last thing that I want to define. So I talked about a link. Now, a linear extension of the causal set is another ordered set so a linear extension of this causal set is a total order with the same set C but with a totally ordered relation. So that means that any pair of elements in C are related under this. And this is a total order that's consistent with the partial order, such that U clearly precedes V defines. A linear extension of this example causal set. So this is not a total order because there are pairs of elements such as V1 and V2 which are unrelated. So an example of a total order would be, you say that V1 strictly precedes V2, which precedes V3, which precedes V4. And that's an ordering which is total, everything's related to everything else, and it's consistent with the order that we have there. Okay. So, and also, so that's the kind of mathematical introduction.
Structs a linear extension.
You complete the drawing there and you choose.
Well, so it's a theorem that for any partial order, there exists a linear extension. Mm. I think that it's even a theorem that so there's multiple different linear extensions. Mm. And so in this one, we said that V1 precedes V2. So you assign this order to the unrelated pairs. But I think there's a theorem that says that if there is always a linear extension which is either says that X precedes Y or Y precedes X, but X and Y are unrelated. So there's lots of different ones. But how you actually construct them for the examples we want is maybe going to become clear. So now I'm going to talk about, so far, this causal set is quite abstract. If our universe was like this, it would not be a very good model.
Can you also complete to the total order by putting equalities? Like, can I choose in your example that V1 equals V2? Or I need to put a strict relationship between the guys?
Well, let's see. So, I'm not sure. So you're sort of saying map everything to one.
Well, there's not a lot in the causal set because of the second rule, right? I mean, they have, if they're, I cannot think of them as different points if their relation goes in both directions.
So this total order is still anti-symmetric. So if you try to impose that V1 precedes V2 and V2 precedes V1, you have to conclude that V1 and V2 are the same.
Yes, and this is an allowed linear extension.
No. So we're interested in how you can make a causal set which is similar to a spacetime, say in a classical system. So you do that by a process called sprinkling. So the idea is you have some Lorentzian manifold and you place points down into your manifold randomly according to a Poisson process with a density parameterized by a number row. And the idea is that if you then take some region of a volume V, the expected number of points in this volume is just equal to the rho V. So that's the rule for how we place our points down. And then to generate the causal relation, we just read that off from the manifold. So this Lorentzian manifold has this causal structure, the light cone structure, and we just say that the sprinkle point precedes this one if in the manifold it precedes. And that generates a causal set that is, in a lot of ways, very similar to the manifold. And this issue about Lorentz invariance comes in because if you follow this Poisson process sprinkling, then in any particular frame, the distribution of points looks very random. And if you boost that frame, it still looks random. It's statistically the same in all frames. Okay, so now I promised you that this talk was about QFT, so I'm just going to review some of our notation in the continuum. So I'm going to talk about propagators for the triangle. Okay, so these are just Green's function. So I'm going to do the analysis in D space-time dimension, in Minkowski space-time of D dimension. Here, M is the mass of your particle, your field, and there's a number of different choices. So so we're going to call the retarded propagator in two dimensions. It's equal to a Bessel function. So here, this is so helpful to find this particular parameter, which is like the proper time. So for, yeah, I can say I'm using the I'm using this signature. Okay, so there's a retarded one. Which is kind of the mirror image of the target, you invert the position. And then there's the final. Okay, so the retarded one is only has support in the future light cone. The advanced one has support in the past light cone, and the final one has support echo. It's oscillating in space light and time light direction. So this is a Bessel function, and this is a particular Hankel function. So they're a bit messy in position space, which is perhaps the reason everyone chooses to work in momentum space, where they have their usual Fourier representation as 1 over p squared minus m. And I'm just going to write down the four-dimensional expressions as well. So, and again, the advance is just the inversion of the type. So, I should say,
Okay. So I'm just writing them out in full, just so you, it's clear that they just are what they are. In the two-dimensional case, they're just these oscillating functions. In the four-dimensional case, they're still oscillating, but now they have singularities on the light cone. So S squared equals zero is the light cone. And so this has singularity on the future light cone, and this has singularity on both light cones. So I've given these dimension superscripts just to denote whether we're working in two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime or four-dimensional. But in general, I'm gonna drop them because the analysis goes through and the definitions go through in any dimension. So we also have the Pauli-Jordan function, capital delta, which is gr minus gr. So so now I've set up the propagators for QFT in the continuum. Now I'm going to talk about the fields. So, a real scalar field, quantum field theory, is represented by a family of operators. On some Fock space. Yeah. And they satisfy various conditions. So first of all, the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. The emission. And they have a commutation. Which is in terms of this Pauli-Jordan thing. Okay, so in addition, there exists a Poincaré invariant vacuum state. In the Fock space, such that the Feynman propagator is given by the time order, and so here time ordering is going from earlier times on the right to latest times on the right. So this is all very standard, but I've just gone into it in some detail because we're going to try and reproduce all this on a causal set. Sorry, where? So now, I'm going to tell you about how to do all this on a causal set. So first of all, we'll start with the propagators.
So so fix a causal set generated by sprinkling as described into a finite causal interval in Cartesian space time dimension V. So let rho be the sprinkling density. And P be the number of sprinkle points. Okay. Now I'm going to write down the appropriate expressions for the retarded propagator for causal sets sprinkled into two dimensions and four dimensions.
Is the methodology here that you have a definition on a generic causal set and it specializes to the one you're about to give? Or do you use the structure of the Minkowski spacetime in the definition of the propagator?
It's the first. So definitions I'm about to give are defined on any causal set.
Good.
In the particular case, when it's generated by the sprinkling process, then it agrees in a appropriate way with the contingent.
So these propagators become p by p matrices. So C is the causal matrix for this particular causal set. So and A is half. E is, and that's m squared over rho. So m is the mass of the particle, and rho is the sprinkling density. And if you sprinkle into four dimensions instead of two dimensions, you don't use C, you use the link matrix. And A is now a bit different. Okay. So these propagators, the idea is that if you generate your sprinkled causal set repeatedly, and work these out and average the values, then they agree with the continuum. And the fluctuations are not so bad. So if you do one particular sprinkling, the agreement is still quite good. I should say that the details about these are in a paper on the archive from last year. And so I actually came to Perimeter in April last year and gave a talk. And the whole talk was all about these retarded properties. And I've been around to various conferences and I say, do you think you can do quantum field theory just with the retarded propagator? And everyone says, no, we need the Feynman propagator. So now I'm back with the Feynman propagator. So these are just really big square matrices, and the ij entry corresponds to the retarded propagator to go from the IBI to VJ in the spring thing. And I mean, it's interesting. You can think about these as sums over particle trajectories in the quantum. But we're not going to take that view now. We're just going to treat these as expressions that give you the right functional form for these particles.
Questions, or is there some construction principle? Or?
So you can think about these as you have your causal set. You can think about them as assigning a weight to different trajectories from one point to another that go with the causal structure, and so this is a kind of discrete path interval. So I had the idea to do the discrete path interval, and then the question was, can you find weights that you can assign to these that give you anything back, that anything you might recognize? And the retarded propagator is a natural choice because it's only got support in the future. Like, and if you only sum over paths that go forward in time, it only has support in the future. Like, so it turns out you can. With these A and B, you match it up. You match it up so that it gives you the right answer. I'll talk at the end about in what sense you match it with the continuum. But for now, I'm going to get through. So
you're now dropping the dimension subscripts. The events propagator is just transpose of this matrix. And the analog of the Pauli-Jordan function is just entirely similar to the continuum. You just take the retarded minus the advanced. Now, this matrix, delta, is skew symmetric. And if you multiply it by I, anticipating its use as a commutation, then it's hermitian and skew symmetric. Okay? So the fact that it's skew symmetric means that its rank is an even number. So I'm going to say rank of I delta is 2s. Okay. Then that means that there are, so these properties also ensure that the eigenvalues of this matrix are real, and that the eigen, and that they appear in positive and negative pairs. Okay. So we're going to just define these eigenvectors, ui and vi, and there's xv's and xu's, and okay. Now, it turns out that it's useful, I'm just going to put this on here, it's useful to define a matrix Q, which is given by okay. So I should say that these U's and V's can be chosen to be orthonormal. And if you take this particular construction, so you can think of UI dagger as the projection onto the UI eigenspace. And you multiply it by the eigenvalue and you sum that. Then this is a Hermitian matrix such that I delta equals Q minus Q transpose Q.
where you used over.
Yeah, so this I is an index, and this I is the square root of minus 1.
No, I mean, that I.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, I'll be more careful now. So now it's time to introduce these field operators. So, so now I'm going to label the point by B sub X and B sub Y. Okay, so so now we suppose that for every element of the causal set, Bx, there exists a field operator on some Hilbert space H. And it's going to be, we're going to have three rules that these operators have to satisfy. And they're going to be taken mainly to be analogous to the continuum. So the first one is that operator is commission. Second one is that y is this commutation rule. And the third one is a bit different to the continuum. So it says if you have some vector w, such that I delta w is zero, then if you take the sum of field operators weighted by the components of w, then that has to be equal to zero. Okay? So I'll explain where that comes from. So something that I should have said over here. If you take condition 3 and you imagine applying this box plus m squared to both sides, what you get is box plus m squared on my delta is 0. So what this is telling you is if you didn't know that your field satisfied the Klein-Gordon equation and you found some kind of linear combination of your fields that commuted with all the phi y, then setting that linear combination to 0 is a bit like imposing the Klein-Gordon. So this is exactly what we've done on the causal set. Okay. So if w is annihilated by I delta, then this particular combination, this linear combination of the field operators, if you work out what the commutation relation is of this with phi y, you get 0. So we've laid out our three rules that these field operators have to satisfy. And now we can define new and these new operators make use of these eigenvectors. So we just take for every eigenvector, we have an associated operator, where we just take the p components of it, and we weight them by the phi, and we add it up. So we have SAI and SAI dagger. And so you can
you can use the commutation relation for the phis to work out the commutation relation for the a's. Get this form. Okay.
Is it just complex conjugates of each other?
Oh. So they're defined. You can choose them to be this orthonormal set. And there's a freedom of a phase. You can multiply each one by a phase. It turns out you can choose your eigenvectors such that they are complex functions. Okay, so that's important to see that this notation is correct.
So AI really is the adjoint of AI dagger. So it's these commutation relations where we look at them now and we say, oh, well, we're going to interpret these as creation and annihilation. And they're not normalized because they've got this vector of lambda. That's okay. So we define a vacuum state in this Hilbert space, H, by the condition that it's annihilated, so the AI daggers are the creation operators and the A's are the annihilation operators. It's annihilated by all the A's, and it's non-biased. So although we don't have, this is kind of the best we can do for what this vacuum state is going to be. Yeah. But now that we have it, we can evaluate the, say, the two-point function. And ahead of myself. So this transformation where you find the A's in terms of the phi's can be inverted. And so now in this form, we can work out the two-point function. So many blackboards. So we can now work out this using the vacuum state we've just defined. We have enough information to work out this two-point function. And I mean, all we do is we substitute, take the product for this, and we damage it between the vacuum state, and we pick out the non-zero contribution. So we get this apparent mess, but it turns out that this is equal to this Q matrix that we defined just set. Okay. So so now we can really appreciate that if you imagine switching X and Y here and taking this away, so essentially expectation value of the commutator, just Q, X, Y, X, Q, like that, from this decomposition. So it really is all nice and consistent. Okay. So now that we have this two-point function, we can finally get around to the Feynman property. So this is again a big P by P matrix. The elements of the matrix. Are this time ordered point, just like in the continuum. Yeah.
If you were just interested in free fields, I guess you could stop at this point and say you've now defined the field theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the time ordering for a generic causal set? Because everything you've done up to this point is generic. You haven't used the spring thing,
Yeah. Which
is very, very interesting. So it would be wonderful if you could make the... Do you need the spring thing for the last step?
No. On top of this, I find a linear extension of the causal set. So this is a total order, which is consistent with the causal order. And this is what we're going to use for the time order.
Can I make a remark? I think that means the string thing, so that these discretized guys correspond to the continuum ones. So this is where we need the string.
That's good, because it would be funny if you could do that without us. But it's very, very interesting that the definition of the quantum field theory goes through for a generic causal set.
Yes. So far it's for a generic finite causal set. The issue about infinite causal sets is that the existence of these eigenvectors, this decomposition, that's a bit more tricky.
So if I can ask another question related to that. Usually we understand the splitting of the operator of the field into the creation-annihilation operators as arising from the definition of positive frequency and hence a choice of a time function on the set.
Mm.
Is that the case here? That is there a time function such that this corresponds to some decomposition of positive negative frequency?
I don't think it's exactly in that framework. So it's not quite clear how these operators correspond to what we do in the continuum. There's definite similarities. And this distinction about positive and negative frequencies is kind of tied in with these positive and negative eigenvectors. So you can kind of think of the U's as positive frequency modes, the E's as negative frequency modes. But maybe it's the U's are the linear combinations of positive frequency, so the V's.
Just to follow up, for every eigenvalue lambda, is the choice of which is U and which is V arbitrary? That is, do you have a separate choice for each one?
So for every eigenvalue, what's the question?
So maybe I'm forgetting. Are the eigenvalues positive? Is that what's
they're saying? Positive and negative. So what we've assumed here, the way we've labeled it, we've assumed that lambda I is always positive. So the eigenvalue for the ui is plus lambda I. The eigenvalue for the vi is minus.
Good, okay. So that's not arbitrary. So that decomposition is fixed by the matrix delta.
Yeah, which in turn is fixed by either the C or L matrix.
That's very interesting. So there is some kind of way
in which he knows. So this decomposition is always defined by finite causal sets, and even if they're generated by sprinkling into Kirk's so in that situation, a decomposition into positive and negative modes is a bit more tricky.
Well, it's not. No, that was going to be my next question. In that situation, it's ambiguous.
Right. If this decomposition exists, that's what I'm saying about it not being clear how it links in with the usual. This certainly exists for any composition.
But even for Minkowski space, it's ambiguous. We just happen to choose one based on a time-like-killing field that is global, which we have the possibility of doing in Minkowski space-time. But you could choose a different one and generate a different, unitarily an equivalent quantum field theory just by a different time function on the Minkowski space. And you somehow don't have that freedom, which is very interesting.
I'd like to say that it's nicer to not have to have a shock.
Sure. If it's really the case, it's really interesting.
Okay. So I'm just going to finish up more explicitly about. So suppose we define an A bar being the causal. For a linear extension of the causal set, then what we have is read this as saying that this is 1 if x comes before y, is earlier than y, even if they're spaced. And this is 1 if x comes after y. So you just switch the two-point function around the q. So it turns out you can re-express this in another form. So this matrix, you can rearrange this and you get that it's as a simple expression. So it's the retarded one plus I times this q. So this is the candidate Feynman property. Okay? Now, it remains to be shown that it links in with the continuum at all. So this, there was analytic work for the retarded one, which where you could show that if you fix 2 points in Minkowski spacetime and you sprinkle a causal set, then there's zero probability that it will contain those fixed 2 points. So you add them into your causal set, and then you work out this retarded propagator between those two points. That gives you a number. You then average that number over all sprinklings with the same density, and that gives you this function on the Minkowski space. Now you can show that for this choice of A and B in two dimensions, that expected value of the propagator is exactly equal to the retarded propagator in two dimensions. And in four dimensions, it's exactly equal to it in the infinite sprinkling density limit. So a finite large density, there'd be some deviation. So what we'd like is some kind of analytic analysis of this KF matrix to do the same thing. Now, it's possible you can rearrange this and you can express the real part of KF as KR, the real part of KF is KR over 2. And then the imaginary part is the real part of Q. So the analytic results from the previous work ensure that the real part of this candidate Feynman propagator gives you the right answer. It's a bit more tricky to look at the imaginary part here, but you can do it through numerical simulation. So I'm hopefully going to try and show you some plots for that.
It's pretty evident from your formula that you chose a linear extension to write this, but it traps out, right? It doesn't matter which linear extension you choose.
Yeah, so as I said right at the start, there's in general multiple different linear extensions. And the fact that the field operators commute for unrelated pairs of elements ensures that the arbitrary order assigned to those unrelated elements doesn't affect this expression of the KF. So it's possible to get your computer and to randomly place your points down with some fixed density. Okay. Do I have to turn the light on him?
If the computer resyncs the camera, the document camera.
Okay.
We can try less illumination in the room.
How do I turn these lights?
There is a switch.
So this has a thousand element courses. Okay. So all the matrices we were talking about that 1,000 by 1,000. And you can see this kind of random process where you randomly place your points down. This is in 1 plus 1, a causal interval from 1 plus 1, a unit of. So you can work out this KF matrix, and you can work out for each pair of sprinkled points the proper time separation. And you do that in the Minkowski background space time. And then you can plot one against the other to see the functional form. Okay. So for causally related pairs of events on that causal set, every blue dot is a pair of causally related events. And you work out the matrix element corresponding to that pair. And you plot the real part. So you can see the red line is the real part of the Feynman propagator in 2D. So I hope you'll agree that there's agreement there. But that's not too surprising, because what I just said was that the real part is a half the target plus the events. So analytically, from previous work, you already expect that there to be quite good agreement.
So that's
a kind of relic of the streak. So this is the absolute value of the property. So over here, it's very close to the light, just inside the future light. And the remarks I have said about these retarded ones being at some over trajectories is kind of apparent there. So if your sprinkle points are almost null related, so one, they don't have much volume in the causal interval between them, then there's not many points that get sprinkled into that volume. So there's not many trajectories that go from the initial point to the final point. And so when you sum over them all, you're only summing over maybe 10 or something. And so you get a contribution from the ones where it goes directly there, and then the ones where it goes via an intermediate point, and two intermediate points, and so on. And they all kind of correspond to these different levels. But once you get to larger properties, there's many more paths that contribute, and it all gets washed out. The sums, it gets washed out. Okay, so this is the new stuff, the imaginary part here. So this Hankel function, H02, the imaginary part actually blows up at the origin. But here on the causal set, the values of the imaginary part of KF just kind of get big. Yeah?
Question about the first thing. Being time like the getting close to the light cone is not a Lorentz invariant concept. So does that mean that for finite densities, Lorentz invariance is breaking down near the light cone?
Time like but near to the light.
So the situation you described in which the volume is getting smaller and therefore there's few points in the sprinkling, yeah. I make a Lorentz transformation, that's no longer true.
So the volume between two closely related points in the causal interval is a Lorentz invariant thing. You boost it, and this one that looked far in the future and far away in space becomes very close. So it just goes on this hyperbola, and it didn't go across.
Okay. So it is breaking down for finite density. It's breaking down, but it's break. There's a continuum practice. The approximation of the continuum is breaking down.
But there
is the way that's Lorentz.
Yeah. When you get down, you really see the discreteness when you're near this. When you only have your volumes only have a few points in, then the mixing up that gives you this emergent continuum behavior. There's less mixing, so you. There's less paths that you're summing over. So
is that true in four dimensions too, where you need to take the infinite volume limit?
Well, I'll get to the four dimensions. Okay.
Yeah. Did you explain why it looks like they're horizontal lines? So it looks like the real part of finally propagated, right?
Yep.
I don't can't read what it says. It looks like that value is quantized.
Yeah, so essentially, imagine you have just a small causal interval, and then maybe just 3 points in it. Then what you do is you get a contribution to go from the initial point to 1 point in here. The final point. So in this case, it would be 3a, where the a was this parameter, a half.
Oh, I see. The point is.
And then you have a contribution where you can go to 2 points, and you get maybe a squared b, but there's, you can go here, and then here, and here. And again, 3.
Yep.
You get the number of 2 paths. And then you get one where it uses all 3, and that's HPP. So what you're seeing is the first layer corresponds to this 3A, and then the next one corresponds to this, But eventually, if you have a million points in here, you no longer see these levels because they all, B has a negative sign, so there's all this cancellation.
Yeah, I see. I mean, the point is that this is the real part, so it's independent of your choice of vacuum state in some sense, or it's completely insensitive to the global boundary conditions. It only depends on that little interval between x and y.
That's right. So it's just half of the
some more local, so to speak, than the imaginary things.
So imaginary part, there's also good agreement, and it's nice because it doesn't blow up on the light cone, it just kind of gets to be where B is.
So that's for causally related pair events. Now, the real part is just zero for a space-like pair event. That's just an identity. But the imaginary part, the space-like separated pair events, has this kind of exponential decay. And this is kind of surprising behavior because when you're just dealing with the causal structure, and you don't have any information about the space-like separated points apart from what is encoded in their causal relations to everything else. So this construction, it samples all the global causal structure, and it gives you the right numbers for the right proper time difference. Yeah, this is the absolute value of the proper time for pairs of points. Now, I'd like to be able to show you similar plots for 4 dimensions, but I can't because you'd only expect good agreement in the large row limit. And because of this delta function here on the light curve, to get a large density sprinkling, you can either put a whole load of points, millions and millions, into a large volume, or you can put a moderate number of points, say 1,000, into a very small volume, and that's still a high density. But then, if you're doing it in a small volume, you only sample the behavior of small profit time. And that is dominated by this kind of smeared out delta function on the light curve. So you don't really get to see the full behavior unless you can do very large causal set simulations. which we can't. So the biggest we might hope to do is maybe 16,000 elements. And if you take the fourth root of that, it's about 11. So that would be 11 discreteness units on this hypercube, which it would be great if you saw the right behavior, that density was large enough, but I wouldn't hold to that.
But I've tried it, and you do, the trouble is, what do you compare it with? So you can't really plot a delta function. So you have to look for this behavior where it's this kind of peaked exponential or something, a Gaussian or something, near the light curve. And it's just, it's harder to see what you compare it with.
But how about the interior, the Hankel function?
Okay, so to get well away from this smeared delta function, you have to go to larger properties. Mm-hmm. But to do that, you need a larger volume, and to have a high density in a larger volume, you need many millions of causal set points. So at the moment, you just kind of see this peaked smeared delta function near the light cone, and you just have the computational power to go for a large density and examine the large property. Okay, so the fact that it works in two dimensions is promising, and I'm just going to conclude with a few speculations on where this can go. So as I said before, I was giving a lot of talks about this retarded propagator, and I'd say, is that enough? And people say, no, you need the Feynman. But now that we have the Feynman propagator, we can imagine doing Feynman diagrams and doing interacting fields. And the legs of the diagrams would be assigned the right weights because we have this propagator. And so the idea is, say, for phi to the fourth theory, you'd be able to work out some scattering amplitude, and then you would get the continuum answer as the main contribution, and then you get these corrections. And hopefully you'd be able to do that by summing all the Feynman. Hopefully that sum would converge because of the space-time discreteness. Whereas in the continuum, it's this asymptotic series, hit the first few terms, and that's good enough. And then, but still, this is still restricted to scalar fields. So another advance would be to incorporate spin or have spin one, spin half, spin one particles on your causal set. And then you'd really be in the, able to make physical predictions. And I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
Any further questions?
This is very, very interesting. So I think it's very encouraging, but I want to nonetheless ask a couple of questions. One of them may be something to explore. If we think of the causal set as really fundamental and the space-time as somehow emergent from it in some approximation, which is, I think, the way we'd all like to think about it, then we would expect the property of the causal structure of the causal set matching the causal structure of the space-time to be something that emerges, and we would expect it to be disordered. So we would expect there to be, say, a finite density of situations where there were two points which were space-like in the metric that we sprinkled into, but are nonetheless causally connected. And this is analogous to issues, analogous issues are studied in statistical physics, where people study, say, an Eisenmann model lattice and then disorder it by randomly connecting a small number of low density points together. So it seems like you could study this and you could ask how bad could this disordering get before we could observe it.
So certainly the bigger goal is to never have to mention the manifold, and to have some rule that constructs causal sets which on large scales resemble the four-dimensional space-time that we observe. That's a work in progress.
Sure.
So the good news for this is that they if you have one of these causal sets, it's growing, it's in, you can still define this property, can't it? A bigger question is how then you expect there to be some kind of gravitational back reaction from the matter, and that's it. Tricky.
No, all those are very interesting questions, but it seems to me one thing that you could investigate in the same sense that Brownian motion is a consequence of the atomic nature of matter, if the causal structure is really atomic, one would expect to see departures from agreement. And they might come from situations where the two causal structures are mismatched.
So you're saying you do a sprinkling, and then you tweak the causal relationship and add in a bit of disorder. Is that what you're saying? And then work this out and see if it.
And the question is that does it? My guess would be that there's a robustness and that one could live with a density of disordering. And then the question is, might there be sort of a leading order effect of the disordering that maybe might be observable in the same sense that Brownian motion was the smoking gun for the atomic nature of matter?
Yeah, well, that'd be great. That's to be done.
You started from a causal set which was not obtained by sprinkling. Then how would you define at least in something within K as a metric?
Metric
distances.
Oh, so this is part of time.
Yeah.
Well, so the first thing I have to say is given any pair of elements, you would have the value of Kf corresponding to that pair for an arbitrary causal set. What that, whether that's an interesting number and how that behaves. It's only really interesting when you generate your causal set by sprint, either into flat space-time or to curved space-time. If you want to kind of understand the functional form, there's a general approach for geodesic distance or time-like related, causally related points. You take the maximum chain you can follow from one to the other. The length of that chain is scales as the geodesic distance. The space-like related points, so that would be fine for the Ricardo. You know it's zero for space-like points. But for the final one, it's a lot harder to define the distance for space-like points just from the causal set. The work has been done on this, and you can do it by kind of examining the causal relations and extract this geodesic distance. That's something that David Rideout wrote. What you then do with the generic causal set, you plot one against the other. I'm not sure that's that interesting at the moment.
And Seth? Can you comment a little bit more about other dimensions? So the definition is in 2 and 4. And is there a way, for instance, to define some sort of matrix that interpolates between the flavors of adjacent flavors? So, I mean, you really have one as one link, and then it's all the relations. Is there some way to interpolate between the two?
I think, as a general rule, even dimensional things have nice properties. The odd dimensions, you in the two-dimensional case, you sum over these links, and then in the four-dimensional case, you sum over the relations. So you can imagine saying, well, I'm going to do a link and then a relation and then a link, or something like that.
Or angles, or
two, yes. So you can imagine more exotic trajectories. I haven't studied that. I was happy enough that you could get it in two dimensions and then simulate it and sort of see that it's right, and then you could get the analytic result in four dimensions. And I thought, like, four dimensions is good.
So quantum field theory, it's also something which is pretty well defined in Euclidean. So you could try to do some deconstruction, dropping completely the causal structure.
Yeah.
like sprinkle points, you know, take the incidence matrix instead of, you know, your C matrix and so on and so forth. You have a propagator which is really defined in Euclidean and so on. Do you recover it if you do this treatment, dropping the causality?
Well, this relies very heavily on this big delta. And that's tied intimately to the causal structure, the like forward lacuna, backward lacuna. So I guess you could do this random sprinkling, and then your notion of nearest neighbor would be Euclidean distance. I'm not too sure what the commutation function, what this right hand side should be in Euclidean, unless
it's perfectly well defined in Euclidean also.
Does it have support everywhere? Or is it?
It is at coincident points. So if they are not at the same point, the fields commute. And if they're at the same point, they don't commute. So you don't have a delta of x minus y. You have like a, you have a kernel, you have a delta. Dirac delta.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can imagine a similar construction might work.
I also have a question, like, I've heard that there are also proposals for having the Dalam version on causal sets.
Mm.
So my question would be, have you tried to compare your Green's function to these Dalam versions? I mean, the Green's function are solutions to equation that involves the Dalam version, right? So would you get the delta function? The delta function on the right hand side of it?
That's a good question. Mm. All right. So If you had this discrete downversion operator and you acted it on the retarded or the advanced or refinement, would you get approximately diagonal matrix?
Yes. So there are these two approaches related.
We haven't looked at that, but it would be interesting to know.
So I have a question for everyone else. There's something here that I had never seen before. I was just wondering if it's known in field theory. I mean, this passing from this delta, whatever you call it, this commutator function to the two-point function by means of diagonalizing the I delta and so on, that whole construction. I've never seen that described and discussed in the continuum. I just wonder if that already known, or
So you can imagine taking this continuum capital delta and trying to work out the continuum eigenvectors and eigenvalues and go through the same procedure. The Raphael is assessing if anyone's seen that in a book before. Because it is a bit more messy because you have all these delta functions, singular distributions and things. So on a causal set, you just do it. Put it into MATLAB and it gives you out these vectors. But in the continuum, maybe because it's so messy, no one's had the motivation to do it.
It's providing you, in some sense, a unique vacuum state. That was the thing you needed for.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than just a technical thing. The thing which is astounding is that the procedure gives a unique Fock space and unique vacuum state. Again, you know, resolving. I wouldn't really want to look at it carefully, but there's been a long-standing problem, very serious problem, which is that we use the words quantum field theory and curved space-time, but we really don't have a procedure to fully construct quantum field theory in any space-time that doesn't have a global timeline Kelly factor, which is, of course, almost all of them. And there are formal constructions like Bob Walt et al., which go some distance, but they never it's a formal algebraic quantization approach, and they never get to define the Fock space because that is somehow then become part of the notion, the sort of C star algebra notion of the state as a measure on a C star algebra. So I think it is very much worth looking into how this happens. So for example, I mean, one way to ask the question is if you took Rinder space time. Is it the global structure? Have you been thinking about that?
I had a conjecture.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the conjecture?
The conjecture is if you just look at propagator on pairs of points which are close to the boundary, you will get the limit. And then what I was going to ask you actually, when you plot, when you do your plots, are you including all pairs of points in the plot?
Yes, that is for all of those points.
Right. So one thing is that I think is the case, that if you take pairs of points just in the interior of your, so it's even sprinkled into a, into a interval, you take the pairs of points just in the interior away from the boundary, it looks better. Mm-hmm. So it's more like the Minkowski system, Lorentz invariant vacuum state there. But the conjecture is if you go to the boundary and look at pairs of points close to one,
which already is it?
You'll get the Rindler. You'll get the Rindler propagator. That's the conjecture.
And
so
where
it's thin.
There has to be a parameter that is measuring somehow how fast you're going to the boundary, which is now plays the role of the acceleration.
Yes.
But I can imagine that emerging. It's very.
And then the conjecture goes, and you can go on and on. So if you sprinkle into the sitter space, and you should get a bunch of Davis vacuum. If you sprinkle into Schwarzschild, you should get a Hawking vacuum. You sprinkle into the exterior of the horizon, and you should get it. So somehow this is picking out the vacuum state which is appropriate, natural, for a region of space.
It would be very, very interesting to investigate that, to see how that works and what's really making that happen.
Okay, and then let's stop here. Thank you again.